Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Lunini versus CLM Freight Lines. How badly, Mr. Weldy, did I butcher that name?
Pretty badly, Your Honor. But you know,
give me a second chance. Why don't you give me the correct pronunciation?
Mr. Lunini.
Lunini.
And it took me 3 or 4 months to get that right myself, Your Honor. So.
All right. So I'm not too far behind the curve.
Not really.
All right.
Good morning, Your Honor. Ronald E. Weldy of Weldy & Associates on behalf of Appellant Monsef Lunini. Mr. Lunini has brought suit against CML Freight Lines, now CCC Freight Lines, claiming discrimination due to his race and national origin. Specifically, Mr. Lunini asserts that Bill Peterson, the vice president and general manager of CML Freight Lines, consistently called him a camel jockey, raghead, and terrorist, and encouraged his other coworkers to harass Mr. Lunini, resulting in a hostile work environment during his employment with CLM Freight Lines.
But this case is obviously a procedural case. The question is whether you got in the door in time with the facts, right?
Correct, Your Honor. I just thought I'd use 20 seconds telling you why the case was filed. Mr. Lunini came to my office seeking representation as to these claims, and I agreed to do so with regard to his EEOC charge and any follow-up district court proceedings. The deadline for him to file his EEOC charge was April 12th of 2007. And on April 12th of 2007, I prepared the charge of Mr. Lunini. My assistant prepared a fax cover sheet to the EEOC using the fax number designated by Lynn Oliver, who is the supervisor for the Indianapolis office responsible for filing charges.
Is that fax number published anywhere, or is this something you just find out by phoning the office?
You know, Your Honor, I honestly don't know the answer to that. I do know that I had been filing charges with the Indianapolis office for a while. I knew who Lynn Oliver was, and that at some point in time during that practice, she had suggested that if I wanted to fax a charge, this was the number I should fax to. I believe in her affidavit it says something along the lines of that she states to attorneys that if you wish to fax to the EEOC, this is the number suggested for the fax number.
She filed an affidavit to that effect, if I remember.
There is an affidavit from Lynn Oliver, and I'm paraphrasing what she said about the fax number, Your Honor.
Now, in the number of times that you had filed, Mr. Weldy, had you ever used fax before?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. Absolutely. The fax cover sheet and the two-page charge of Mr. Lunini were faxed to the designated EEOC fax number. The fax cover sheet requested that the charge be file stamped as of April 12th of 2007. The fax machine that my office uses actually prints a record of each fax transmission. This record establishes that a three-page fax was successfully transmitted to the designated EEOC fax number at 4:05 p.m. on April 12th of 2007. Ms. Oliver also testified in her affidavit that charges faxed on a business day to the Indianapolis office to the designated number between 8 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. will be filed on that date. I confirmed that the EEOC had received the fax by reviewing the fax confirmation sheet generated by my fax machine.
So that's the sheet you've got at page 22, right, of your appendix.
Yes, that is correct.
HP Laser Jet.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And the fax cover sheet that I was just referencing is actually page 21.
Okay.
And I believe...
Now, your opponents say, well, something or other was faxed to this number, but how do we know it was the complaint, the charge?
Correct, Your Honor. In my affidavits, I stated that according to my records, there was only one fax to the EEOC on that date, and it was the charge of Mr. Lunini. So we didn't fax anything else to the EEOC on that date.
Mm-hmm.
And, Your Honor, just to let you know, the declaration of Lynn Oliver starts on record number, page number 23 of the appendix, and concludes on page 24, since I referred to it earlier. The charge of Mr. I've already stated that. My office also mailed copies of Mr. Lunini's charge to the EEOC on April 12, 2007. And this isn't in the record, but my recollection from talking to Ms. Oliver about, you know, this procedure was, hey, Ron, if you're going to fax it in, go ahead and mail us hard copies because we need so many hard copies for the records or for the file anyway. But that's not in the record anywhere.
Let me jump ahead and ask you whether you think the question of timely receipt is the kind of fact question that a jury would need to consider, or is this something that the trial court would properly resolve?
Well, Your Honor, that is something that I've thought about in this case a lot. I haven't been able to truly find any definitive answer, legally speaking, on that question. I believe that Judge Barker said it on page one of her opinion, that a material question of fact exists as to whether or not the EEOC did receive this charge via fax on April 12th of 2007. And to the extent that a material question of facts exists as to that issue, then I would think that a jury would be the only body who could answer that question. But I don't have any type of case or any statute that I can cite to that definitively says that that's supposed to be the case. At least I haven't been able to find one yet.
Well, I mean, in some ways it's an important question for you because if one were to read the trial court's opinion as resolving that fact against you and saying there's no receipt, then you'd be out of luck. If it's a jury question, of course, then we approach it in a somewhat different way. Now, under the a statute of limitations defense like this would be approached by a jury.
Your Honor, I'm going to agree and disagree with you on that statement. I agree that, yes, obviously, to the extent that the material question of fact exists and that this court believes that it's not the purview of the district court but the jury to decide it, then obviously that's in my favor. But it would be our opinion that even if this court were to find that this was a question for the district court to resolve on a factual basis and not the jury, that looking at the evidence, there simply wasn't enough evidence at this time to make the determination that Judge Barker made in this case. There needs to be additional facts that need to come out in order for defendant CML Freight Lines to overcome the evidence that we have. I mean, they do
what,
have
what
the burden.
What facts are you thinking of?
Well, Your Honor, we don't have any facts as to whether or not the fax machine of the EEOC was working correctly or malfunctioning on April 12th of 2007. We really don't have any idea as to what procedures the EEOC has in terms of how faxes are handled.
If it had been malfunctioning, could your receipt have said the word success?
Your Honor,
as a matter of fax technology?
I believe that the answer is no, but I cannot sit here and definitively say that. I know there has been no expert called in this case who can translate, or give an opinion on what, you know, success means in terms of fax technology. And so while I would like to think from a common sense mode that if for some reason the fax machine on the other end of the line was malfunctioning, then mine would have came back with a communication error, which is another common designation that would come back when the fax didn't go through, I can't sit here today and definitively state that that's the truth because I don't know that fact. There are a lot of questions here that are simply not answered in terms of the facts to determine whether or not this fax transmission was or was not received by the EEOC for a variety of reasons.
Now, I just have you're in your rebuttal time, but I cannot resist asking you. Waiting to the last day produces. I mean, I'm sure you love coming here to Chicago to argue before us, but it's a kind of a brinksmanship approach, isn't it?
I've never met a lawyer who didn't practice like that, Your Honor. Everybody files their briefs on the last day. And people file charges.
No, it's the last 25 minutes, isn't it? This isn't just the last day. This is the last 25 minutes.
And I often file federal briefs online at 11:55 p.m., Your Honor. So, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Weldy. Mr. Paul.
May it please the Court. The simplest way to resolve this case is simply to read the relevant regulation and apply it to the facts of this case. And the relevant regulation is 1601.8. And it says that there are two methods for filing a charge, in person or by mail.
But if that regulation isn't about methods, though, that's about where you file.
And according to the text, it's also about how you file. If you look at the...
But where does it say you may not file by fax?
It doesn't say that, but the Supreme Court has said that when a statute or a regulation lists certain methods of doing something, other methods not listed are implicitly excluded.
Well, that's an interesting philosophical question. You know, is everything forbidden that's not permitted, or is everything permitted that's not forbidden?
Well, in this way, I think this rule is very much like our own appellate rules. 25A2A says that filing may be accomplished by mail, but that doesn't also mean that filing may also be accomplished by fax. It's only by virtue of another rule, 25A2D, that the various circuit courts can adopt a local rule that allows for electronic filing. In fact, the Federal Circuit has adopted a rule that allows for fax filing.
What does that do, if you're correct, what does that do with other cases that are filed by fax? Are they all not legitimate?
They're invalid to the extent that the defendant raises the defense. In response...
Well, why is that? No, wait a minute. If they're invalid any time you file them by fax, they're just invalid, right?
Well, what I'm talking about is in terms of timeliness. Timeliness is a statute of limitations. It's an affirmative defense that you have to affirmatively raise. If it's not raised, it's waived. And I think that this falls into that same category.
But, you know, the problem I have a broader problem with your approach, which has to do with the entire system that the EEOC has set up for charge filing and for the administration of Title VII. It's supposed to be something that real people can use. It is supposed to be something that has all sorts of informal user friendliness, if I can say that. And so in that sense, it seems quite in keeping with it that the affidavit from the EEOC officer in the Indianapolis office said, sure, you know, we'll take it by fact. We'll take, you know, this is to get the ball rolling. It's to get the EEOC into the conciliation phase, if that turns out to be possible. That's the whole reason we have this stage, instead of having people just go straight off to court and go into the more formal procedures such as the ones you're talking about. And so I'm not at all sure, in light of this statute as a whole, that the principles that you're talking about for appellate briefs really carry over.
Well, I think that they do.
Is that consistent with the fact that you don't need a lawyer? Why is that consistent with the informality of the process?
Well, theoretically, you don't need a lawyer to prosecute a case in federal court. Pro se plaintiffs and defendants are bound by the same appellate rules that lawyers are, and the same goes for EEOC regulations. Look, this is a nationally applicable regulation that was promulgated by the notice and comment process. A court does not have the authority to effectively amend that regulation by implication. If the EEOC has the right to define for itself what procedures it wants to use in terms of filing, just as the courts do, and for whatever reason, the EEOC at the national level has decided that it is not going to allow fax filing at this time,
You're reading its failure to list fax filings, that sort of thing, and I'm not sure about that. It hasn't listed it. Let's go that far.
Correct. And I would go back to the canon of construction that the Supreme Court has used more than once, and recently as 2000, and it has said that when a statute or regulation lists various methods of doing something, other methods not listed are excluded.
Well, Mr. Paul, should we make of the possibility that Mr. Weldy has been misled by an official of the agency, the agency charged with not only the receipt but interpreting the regulations?
Well, if he feels that he has been misled, it's his obligation to raise the argument of equitable tolling, and he's not done that. He has not raised the argument of equitable tolling. The other reason equitable tolling doesn't apply in this case, the Supreme Court, by the way, has said that what you're really talking about is equitable tolling.
Yeah.
And what the Supreme Court has said, that doctrine is to be applied sparingly. And this court has said that it's only to be applied when the plaintiff has exercised all due diligence.
And he filed by April 12th, and the postmark on the letter is certainly April 12th. This isn't one of those cases where months go by after the deadline.
Well, his client signed the charge, apparently, on November 10th, 2006, and for whatever reason, it took another 5 months for the file to be charged the following April.
And, you know, we don't know what that reason is, and you're assuming that it must be a bad reason, but a responsible lawyer might look into it. I've seen plenty of employment complaints that had no merit whatsoever, and responsible lawyers have tried to calm down the person who wanted to file a complaint and said, don't do this. And so perhaps further investigation is called for sometimes.
Well, I'm not suggesting a bad reason. What I'm suggesting is
I think you're implying a bad reason, actually.
What I'm saying is all due diligence was not exercised. The other thing I would say about equitable tolling.
But due diligence, if you ask the agency, how can I file it, they say fax it.
Well, again, Mr. Wellman.
And they give you a dedicated number.
Well, let me address one more point about that. This court has also said, and other courts have said, that when a plaintiff is represented by counsel, the case for applying equitable tolling is substantially weakened. And obviously, Mr. Leoini is represented by counsel. But I would reiterate that that argument has never been put forth. And this court, in other instances, has said that when you fail to raise equitable tolling, it's waived. Let me turn to the issue that you've addressed with Mr. Weldy, and that is the issue of receipt. It was our burden to show an absence of a genuine issue of material fact on this issue, and we did that.
I don't see how you did that at all, actually. Particularly, you use the analogy to mailing, and proof of putting something in the Postal Service creates a rebuttable presumption of receipt. And so it seems to me that analogy actually is unhelpful to you.
He
has good proof in the facts, actually better proof than putting something in a mailbox, because at least according to my understanding of the way fax machines works, there's an electronic handshake, and you couldn't get that success message unless the receiving fax machine had an electronic communication.
I'd like to address that presumption issue, but if you just want to bring you back to the fax call report, which is on page 22 of the short appendix. It doesn't have a lot of information, but one of the things it says is type, and then under that it says send. And you go over a couple more categories, and it says result, and it says success.
And it has the EEOC's phone number there for identification, 226-7953.
I really do think that this is very much like a postmark. It indicates successful transmission or exiting of the machine. But
and I'm saying it's not success. Success means there's a handshake. Success means the other machine was functioning. It wasn't a busy signal. Sometimes they say busy. It wasn't any number of other things it might have been.
I'm not sure that there are those facts in the record to prove that. Mr. Weldy didn't, or I should say the plaintiff.
Do you ever fax things?
I do.
Okay.
And the plaintiff did not come forward, for example, with the manual for the HP fax machine, talking about what this confirmation sheet means and saying, for example, that success means receipt. You have to look
once there's a rebuttable presumption of receipt, wasn't it up to you to show that this didn't mean receipt?
Well, there wasn't a rebuttable presumption for at least a couple of reasons. First of all, Mr. Leoini has never argued for a rebuttable presumption, so that argument's waived. But beyond that, you know, if the EEOC really did allow for fax filing, adopting a rebuttable presumption in this case might be justified. But again, the EEOC, by implication, does not allow for fax filing, and so this is not the right.
Except in Indianapolis.
I'm sorry?
Except in Indianapolis, apparently.
Well, except the local district office, which has no authority to counter a nationally applicable regulation.
Yeah, but
how do you
does
know
it factor
that?
In a, when we lay it against the vignette we have here, Mr. Paul? In other words, whether should it be considered, when if we look at equitable tolling, that we have this dialogue between Mr. Weldy and the official at the EEOC.
Right, and again, I would reiterate there are a number of reasons not to apply that. Most importantly, he didn't raise the argument. The other thing is, you know, when you're dealing with the U.S. Mail, which is a government agency, very standardized procedures, we just have no evidence to indicate that fax machines, I imagine there are hundreds if not thousands of different models, all operate perhaps somewhat differently with different degrees reliability. It doesn't seem to me that adopting that kind of presumption in this case makes sense. And in any event, I would say that we have rebutted it for the reasons that we've already discussed.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Paul. Mr. Well, do you have any time left? 1 minute?
No, sure. I'm willing to waive my time unless the court has other questions.
No, I guess not. Thank you. Thanks to all counsel. The case.